Did man come into being through creation or evolution? Can we depend on the Bible for accurate scientific information? These questions were the subject of a debate between Dr. Robert C. Newman, professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary, and Dr. David Frame, pastor of the Fox Chase United Methodist Church in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, on May 20, 1979. Dr. Frame is first with his opening statement.
I think that the most beneficial time we're going to spend together this evening will be the discussion time. And I will try to make my presentation now as brief as I can in order to allow maximum time for discussion. What I would like to present to you is my understanding of biblical creation thought, what the Bible says about creation. What I say is, of course, open to debate. This is my understanding. You will notice probably that what I leave out is as significant as what I say. It is my belief that there are numerous questions that the Bible doesn't care about and doesn't make any pronouncement concerning. And we are wrong if we try to get the Bible to answer questions that the Bible itself doesn't want to answer. Biblical creation thought. Let me begin by saying that in the earliest stages of the history of Israel, there was probably no theological significance attached to the matter of creation. When we get back to some of the earliest texts of the Old Testament, we find that creation is not mentioned as an important doctrine of the faith. Now that may shock us somewhat, in that as we open our Bibles and read the book of Genesis, we start with the story of creation. And so we sort of think that theologically that's the place to start, that we would start by thinking about how the world got here in the first place. And it might be interesting for you to know that that was not the case with Israel. Israel did not begin theologically with an understanding of creation. If there was one event that was the seminal event, the event from which Israel began to reason and think theologically, it was the Exodus event, the escape of Israel from Egypt. It was that event that had brought her into being as a nation. When we read in Psalm 100, "It is He that has made us, and not we ourselves," what they're referring to is not an act of creation, such as we would think, the creation of mankind in the beginning, but they're talking about the creation of their nation. It was the Exodus that brought Israel into being as a people. And before Israel ever thought about creation of the natural universe, she had an understanding of God as the one who had brought her into being. God was her father, was her begetter, was the one that had created her. Now, after Israel settled down in the land of Canaan, she came into contact with an agricultural society where various forms of nature cults were important. Cults surrounding particularly the god that you know from the Old Testament as Baal, and numerous other gods that formed that pantheon. There soon developed a contest between Yahweh and Baal, Yahweh being the god of Israel. Up to this point, Yahweh had been a god of nomadic people, a god who was a god of the desert, a god who was a god of war, but a god who was not very much associated with agriculture, because out in the desert you don't do much raising of crops. But once Israel settled in Canaan, the question came up, who does control the crops? Who does make the fields to grow? Who does send the rain? Who does control the sunlight? Canaanite cult said that it was Baal who sent the rain, that it was Baal who was the god of fertility, that it was Baal who made the crops to grow. Some of the Hebrews, of course, wavered and accepted that. But the prophetic school held up Yahweh as now being not just a God of the desert, but a God of the cultivated land as well, a God who controlled the natural world as much as he controlled the world of history. And you remember the great contest of Elijah and the prophets of Baal upon Mount Carmel, where the question is really being debated, who sends the rain? Who does control the forces of nature? Is it Baal or is it Yahweh? And you remember the outcome of that great contest is that Yahweh is the one who sends the rain. At this point then, Yahweh is not just a God of historical events, but is starting to also be a God whose sway over the natural universe is being understood. And we're moving a little bit closer to a clear understanding of what we would recognize as creation thought in the religion of Israel. Now around the year 1000 or so BC, King David managed to conquer the city of Jerusalem and to install himself on Mount Zion as king. That city had not been an Israelite city. You'll remember it was one of the few enclaves of Canaanite culture that was not conquered during the time of the initial conquest of the land. And when David managed to win the city for his own private capital, he spared the Jebusite population. He did not annihilate them. He allowed them to go on living in that capital. He brought his court, his special friends to Jerusalem. But by and large, the population of Jerusalem remained Canaanite, and their culture continued. The cult that was practiced at Jerusalem also, to a large extent, continued. The only thing was that now the God who had been worshipped at Jerusalem, a God that we can identify by the name El Elyon, or God the Highest, was identified with Yahweh. Many of the hymns, many of the songs, many of the festivals that were associated with El Elyon now became associated with Yahweh. The two gods were merged. Now, it was in this cult of Jerusalem that we find some very clear creation thought. Back in the 1920s, there were some tablets discovered at a site known as Ugarit in the area of what nowadays would be Lebanon. And these tablets revealed much of the mythology of the Canaanite people who lived in Israel at the same time that the Hebrews were entering. And in these tablets, we not only meet Baal, but we also meet the god El, E-L. And we can gain an impression of the type of god that this god El was. We find that he was very much the father of the gods. He is the creator of all living beings. He is the one who controls the various forces of creation that from time to time fight and struggle with one another. And we have a myth of the god Baal, who struggles with another god who is known as Yam, or the sea. And we can see in this a typical struggle of the sea with the land, the sea with the cultivated land. We have another struggle between Baal and a god whose name is Mot, or death, but really representing the hot desert winds that blow into the cultivated land. You have that narrow strip of Palestine, you have the sea on the one hand and the desert on the other hand, and in the mythology we see represented this struggle of the created, the fertile land against the sea and the desert. And El, the creator god, is the one who tries to control this conflict, who doesn't allow one force to usurp too much over the other forces of nature. In other words, he keeps creation in balance. He has set it up, and he now tries to preserve the order that he has established. Now, many hymns that celebrated El Elyon, El, the creator god, passed into the liturgy of the worship of Yahweh. And it is really in the cult at Jerusalem that we begin to get a clear development of what we would then call creation thought. Now, Israel was very eclectic. She would draw imagery. She would draw ideas, concepts from almost any source that was readily available to her in order to describe the work of her God. Usually she would transform them and make them acceptable in terms of belief in Yahweh. The gross pagan elements would be rejected or refined. But still we can trace the number of the sources from which Israel derived these thoughts about Yahweh, particularly in regard to creation. I've already mentioned some. From Babylonia, she got the concept of creation as being the result of a struggle of the Creator God with some monster of chaos. The Babylonian myth, which had passed into Canaanite culture, saw the unruly sea as representing primeval chaos, misrule, anarchy, formlessness. And the Creator God must struggle against this force of chaos, pictured as a monster, must destroy it in battle, and then must proceed to create the orderly universe. Now we have some recollections of that understanding in our Old Testament. I don't know how many of you have Bibles, but in Isaiah chapter 51, you would have one classical reference. Isaiah 51 at verse 9, "Awake, awake, put on strength, O arm of the Lord. Awake as in the days of old, the generations of long ago. Was it not thou that didst cut Rahab in pieces and didst pierce the dragon?" The mythological background of that statement is this war, this battle, this struggle between the Creator God and the monster of chaos, out of which issues then the order of the created world. Another image that is much more pervasive, by the way, in the Old Testament than that battle image of creation is the image of building the universe. I particularly like to think that image is due to the mythology that surrounded the god El, or El-Elyon, who was pictured as a very orderly kind of person, and who builds houses for Yam and for Baal and for all his children, thereby structuring the universe. The imagery of Yahweh as builder is very extensive in the Old Testament. Just a few passages that we can look at. For instance, in Proverbs chapter 8, we read as follows. The speaker, by the way, is a personified wisdom. And she says, "The Lord created me at the beginning of his work, the first of his acts of old. Ages ago I was set up, at the first, before the beginning of the earth. When there were no depths, I was brought forth, when there were no springs abounding with water. Before the mountains had been shaped, before the hills, I was brought forth. Before he had made the earth with its fields, or the first of the dust of the world. When he established the heavens, I was there. When he drew a circle on the face of the deep. When he made firm the skies above. When he established the fountains of the deep. When he assigned to the sea its limits, so that the waters might not transgress his command. When he marked out the foundations of the earth. Then I was beside him like a master workman, and I was daily his delight, rejoicing before him always." Now you definitely have the picture there of a construction operation. Wisdom is serving as the master workman, fulfilling the grand design of this architect, this building God, who is constructing his universe. If you turn to the book of Job, you will find the same imagery, Job chapter 38. In this particular section, you remember Yahweh is asking Job a series of embarrassing questions that he doesn't believe Job can answer. And he says, "Where were you when I laid the foundation of the earth? Tell me, you have understanding. Who determined its measurements? Surely you know. Who stretched the line upon it? On what were its bases sunk? Who laid its cornerstone when the morning stars sang together and all the sons of God shouted for joy? Who shut in the sea with doors when it burst forth from the womb?" Here again, you have this picture of the orderly builder who has taken measurements, who has sunk the foundations of the earth. In Psalm 104, we find it again. Bless the Lord, O my soul, O Lord my God, thou art very great, thou art clothed with honor and majesty, who coverest thyself with light as with a garment, who has stretched out the heavens like a tent, who has laid the beams of thy chambers on the waters. Verse 5, thou didst set the earth on its foundations, so that it should never be shaken. Thou didst cover it with the deep as with a garment. The waters stood above the mountains, but at thy rebuke they fled. And at the sound of thy thunder they took their flight. The mountains rose, the valleys sank down to the place which thou didst appoint for them. Thou didst set a bound which they should not pass, that they might not again cover the earth. Again, the picture is one of a builder who sets the earth on its foundation and then holds back the water so that the dry land can appear. Now, those are three of the major references. I could give many, many more references to where this image of God as the builder is the major creation image of the way in which God made the world that we find within the Old Testament. Now, besides the image of creation through a battle, which is very minor, and besides this image of God as a builder, which I think is a major image, there is, of course, also that image of the God who creates by his word. And I believe probably the locus for that idea would come from the understanding of kingship that prevailed in Israel and in other ancient Near Eastern countries, that when a king spoke a command, it was done. And we have Yahweh portrayed as the king of the universe, who simply speaks a command with the understanding that then it will be done. You have this understanding of creation by the word in such places as Psalm 33, verses 6 and 7. By the word of the Lord, the heavens were made, and all their hosts by the breath of his mouth. And Psalm 148, verses 5 and 6. Let them praise the name of the Lord, for he commanded, and they were created. And he established them forever and ever, and fixed their bounds, which cannot be passed. Now, of course, the most familiar section to us with this idea of creation by the word is Genesis chapter 1. And I could spend the rest of the night talking on Genesis chapter 1, since that was the subject of my dissertation. But we will leave that go for the time being until we get the question and answer session, and you will obviously raise some specifics at that point. What I tried to show you up to now in my final minute is that when we begin to talk about the way in which the Bible pictures creation, there is no one biblical view of creation. There are many biblical views of creation. They are conditioned by the social environment in which Israel lived. She borrowed freely from her surrounding cultures, finding those symbols, those mythological images that spoke to her and suited her need. What can we derive then from these creation stories? If we can't use them for any scientific information, which is my contention, what are they in the Bible for anyway? What are we supposed to get out of them? Four very brief points. First of all these creation stories tell us that God is sovereign, that he does control the world, he made it, and he rules over it. Secondly, these stories tell us that evil is not eternal, that God created the world good, so that the evil that prevails in the world is something that is a part of the created world and was not there before creation, and since it has a beginning, it can have an end. Thirdly, the creation stories show us that man has a special part in creation. Man is God's highest creature and given the special role as God's steward in this universe. Finally, that there is a purpose for creation. According to Genesis 1, that purpose is portrayed in the Sabbath rest. And as the pious Hebrew Jew entered into the Sabbath rest, he felt that at that moment he was entering into the goal of all creation and sharing the Sabbath rest of his God. I pause there. Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. My discussion will come from the whole matter of creation and evolution from a little different perspective than Reverend Frame. I'd like to look first of all at the Genesis account of creation. I understand it to be a revelation from the God who put things together of what it's all about. Naturally, its major purpose is not telling us exactly how things happen, but yet I think that is a purpose of the matter. We see, I believe, in the Genesis account, an origin of the universe, a statement that things have not always been around. The universe we see around us has not always existed. I take this to be in the first statement, in the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth, a statement of using the phrase heavens and earth in a universal sense. We then have a description of the creation of the earth itself, which takes up a substantial fraction of the material, and then a description of the creation of life, so that the Bible comes down rather definitely on the side that the universe has not always existed, the earth has not always existed, life has not always existed, and that life came into existence not by purely natural processes, but by an intervention of the one who made everything. I see also in this material a planned sequence of interventions by God into a natural order which he was putting together. It appears to me there's an argument about this among those who take the Bible as a revelation, that the statement, let there be light, in verse 3, is a picture of the formation of the sun, which does not appear, however, to one's view. I take the standpoint of narration to be what a person would see if he was there watching, if he were, so to speak, on what is going to be the planet and watching things happen, so that he sees light early in the account, but he does not see where it's coming from. He sees day and night, but does not know what has caused them. So I take the statement, and God said, let there be light, and there was light in verse 3, as a picture of the formation of the sun. Then I would see in verses 4 and 5 a picture of the formation of the planet Earth itself. The term Earth has been mentioned twice already in the account, though the one, I think, is using it in the sense of everything, heavens and earth, all there is. And the second one tells us, in fact, that it's formless and empty. And some people take that to mean covered with water, and that's all. I take it to be much more vacuous, rather like a large gas cloud of some variety. So I would see then the point where we have the separation of light from darkness and the naming of the light day and the naming of the darkness night to be giving us a hint that we are now having the planet formed. You realize that neither in English nor in Hebrew do the word light and day nor darkness and night mean the same thing. In both of them, light can be produced in many ways, and darkness is the absence of light. And day means a certain type of light, and night means a certain type of darkness. So I would see that the planet has formed from a formless, shapeless thing in verse 2 down to a form in which there would be a separation between light and darkness, and then a proper use of the terms day and night in verse 5, so that we now have a planet rotating, so that the side that the sun is shining on has got day, and the side that it's not on has got night. We see next then, in verses 6 through 8, the formation of the firmament. The rakia is a Hebrew word. There's considerable debate about exactly what this is. My understanding of the matter is that it is the atmosphere itself. We have the formation of the atmosphere after the formation of the solid planet. It is one of the things that the Bible calls heaven. The Bible calls heaven the place where the birds lie, and the place where the stars are, and the place where God is in some special way. We tend to call the first of these the atmosphere, the second outer space, and the third heaven, I suppose. I would take this to be the first of these. However, then in verse 9, we have a statement regarding the creation of dry land. Let dry land appear. The creation of dry land is not apparently that there wasn't any dry land around before. It's just that we don't normally think of it as dry when it's under a mile or so of water. So we have apparently a universal ocean at some period in the history of the earth, and then God produces a situation in which dry land appears out of this. We then have, rather naturally, I think, a description of the creation of plant life, land plant life, if you look at the narration here. God called the dry land earth, etc. Let the earth sprout vegetation, he says in verse 11. Naturally, you don't expect to have land vegetation until you've got some land to have on, so that sequence is quite understandable. Then in verses 14 through 18, we have the statement, let there be lights in the expanse of the heavens to separate the day from the night, let them be for signs and for seasons and for days and for years. Many people have interpreted this to mean that the sun, moon, and stars were created at this point. Yet in fact, the narrative says, let these things be in the sky to do something. And in fact, they could have been in the sky before that, but if you couldn't see them, they would not be doing that. A rather cloudy day today, even in these modern times, the sun rises, and you don't know exactly when it rises because the clouds are thick enough that you can't see it come up. You just know that it gradually gets light, gradually gets dark. That's my suggestion for what's going on here. And it is only at this time that these lights will begin to carry out the functions that are mentioned for them in verse 14, that the sun will separate the day from the night, that the sun, moon, and stars will function for signs and seasons and days and years. The seasons are, of course, marked off by the relation of the sun to the stars, the months marked off by the relation of the sun to the moon, and the day, I think, we understand well enough. The year, likewise, is a one cycle of the sun through the stars, so actually one cycle of the earth around the sun, but I'm looking at it from a earthbound perspective here. We then have the creation of the animals in verses 20 through 22. Sea and air animals are mentioned first, their creation, and then in the following section, the creation of land animals and men in verses 24 through 30. I've been rather struck with the correlation which we have in this material with the data of modern science. In fact, I was so struck by it that finally wrote a book on the subject, and although I won't plug my book right here, I'll say something about it in the question and answer session if you'll be so kind as to answer me a question about it. So basically, some rather striking correlations we have here. They involve, first of all, evidence today that the universe had an origin. That has been a rather hotly disputed subject in the last 30 years, since World War II anyway. One of your major theories of the universe was it's always existed, so-called steady-state theory of the universe. We haven't got time to discuss cosmology now, but basically the evidence has gone rather badly against that in recent years. And just a year or two ago, Robert Jastrow, a professor at Columbia and at Dartmouth, and the director of NASA's Goddard Institute of Space Studies in New York City, made a point which I had thought about a great deal before, but figured nobody paying attention to me. I do have a doctorate in astrophysics, but I'm not a practitioner. This fellow's a practitioner. He pointed out that cosmologists have been very strongly trying to avoid a creation for a generation or so, and yet the evidence points right in that direction. He himself is an agnostic, but he says the evidence really does point that way. He views himself as a scientist climbing up a mountain and coming to the top and finding the theologians sitting there on top. I wouldn't put a great deal of weight on that particular analogy, but that's a rather striking thing. It's rather interesting that we have, I don't say that we understand for sure how the Earth was formed today, but the most popular theory in the area does involve the Earth coming from a gas cloud, a shapeless, empty object, better than any vacuum we could make on Earth, and having been formed from that, the biblical material fits that quite well. The present understanding of the matter, there was some dispute here, would seem to suggest that in the early history of the Earth, it was once completely covered by water, and then the movement of the plates, the movement of the continents, if you like to think of this actual plate movement, eventually produced a situation in which you begin to get continents pushing up through the surface of the water to produce dry land. Naturally, plant life would come after you've got dry land to have land plants on. That's understandable. But what's rather funny here is there is a feature in the creation account here that's not symmetrical. The first part of the account speaks of forming the what we might call the inorganic part of man's environment. His planet, his atmosphere, the ground, and things of that variety. And the last part basically speaks of the formation of life. But there's one spot where one section of the life is brought forward, and one section regarding the environment is pushed backward. So you have the appearance of the sun, moon, and stars occurs after the formation, after the creation of the plant life. Now what's very striking in that area is that modern planetologists, those who study planets and planetary atmospheres, understand that the reason that our atmosphere is as clear as it is that we have plant life here. That the plant life has converted carbon dioxide, which is a very good thing for holding heat, and it causes a great deal of our water to form into clouds and bump up the atmosphere so it'd be very cloudy, that plants convert that into oxygen. Oxygen is not quite so good a trap of heat, does not produce as good a greenhouse effect. As a result, the temperature would begin to fall, the heavy clouds would begin to thin down, and you would begin to then see out from inside your atmosphere. It's very striking then here that at one point where the Genesis account departs from its symmetry of discussing the inorganic first and the organic second, it does so at a very point which modern study of the plants that we have around the study would suggest is, in fact, the crucial feature in clearing our own atmosphere. And then, by the way, producing an atmosphere which animals can live in. Plants can get along in the atmosphere with very little oxygen because they make their own oxygen. Animals cannot. And so we have the creation of plant life first, the clearing the atmosphere, then we have the creation of the animals. Now there's one area where there's quite a bit of argument about the matter of correlation between Genesis account and modern science, and that's the whole area of evolution. The Bible is quite explicit on the origin of man, that it puts it in Genesis chapter 2 in such a way that an evolutionary view in the strict sense is not possible to agree with the biblical account. One can argue more about some of the material in Genesis 1, let the earth bring forth, let the waters bring forth. Maybe that would be consistent with evolution, but not the statement, and God took a piece out of the side of Adam and caused him to fall into deep sleep, that the order reversed, sorry, there, put him to sleep first, and made Eve out of it, which is rather definite, something that does not agree with modern evolution. However, it's not often realized that there's some rather serious scientific problems with the theory of evolution. Although the Genesis 1 account is consistent with, I think, a theistic evolution, the Genesis 2 remarks about the origin of man are not consistent with a theistic evolution that does not have man a special creation. So we do have, I think, a conflict here, and yet the interesting thing here is that there are some very serious scientific problems with evolution which are not widely discussed because most scientists do not believe in the miraculous. They do not believe in the intervention of God into the universe. And under such circumstances, we've got life. We haven't always had life. It must have come naturally. Well, my problems here would be several. These are scientific problems with evolution. One of them would be the origin of life from non-life. Very few people realize how complicated the simplest forms of life are. Carl Sagan, in his Encyclopedia Britannica article, Life, points out that the simplest living cell has got an enormous information content in it. And he says it this way, the information content of a simple cell has been estimated at around 10 to the 12th power bits, computer language, comparable to about 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica. If you figure out how much 100 million pages in Encyclopedia Britannica is, it turns out to be 4,000 sets. One of the simplest living cells that will function by themselves have as much information stored in their nucleus as equivalent to 4,000 different sets of the Encyclopedia Britannica. Not 4,000 duplicates, 4,000 sets of completely different material. Scientists are stuck with the problem of getting from simple inorganic chemicals to an operating structure that has that amount of information in it, with nothing but random processes to work with. Now, it's true that you'll hear people say things like, give enough monkeys enough time, and they'll eventually type out the Encyclopedia Britannica. But you need to ask how many monkeys and how much time you need. Well, I stopped and did a very simple calculation in that direction, showing you the problem of producing order out of randomness. Imagine that we are going to do a much simpler job. We're going to type the title, Encyclopedia Britannica. And imagine we're going to do it with all caps, no lower cases. And imagine we get foolproof or monkey-proof electric typewriters to do the job with. Okay? A typewriter that when you push a button, you will get a uppercase English letter, or you'll get a space or a period or a comma or the other sorts of things. In fact, I left room for 33 keys on this typewriter. All the letters of the alphabet plus a space and a comma, most of the punctuation. Imagine if the monkeys were trained to be able to type at 3 characters per second. That's not too fast for trained typists, but that's all pretty fair for a monkey. What kind of a job are you talking about in terms of, you know, we talk about jobs in terms of man hours. How many man hours will it take to do this job? What are we talking about in terms of monkey years to type out the two words, Encyclopedia Britannica, spell Encyclopedia, P-A-E-D-I-A, like they do in the front of that volume. What kind of job is it? Well, it's not hard to calculate. The job is 100,000 billion, billion monkey years. That is, if you have 100,000 billion, billion monkeys, the chances are 50-50 that one of them will do the job in a year. If you've got one monkey, the chances are 50-50 that it will take them 100,000 billion, billion years. That is to get the information content of the title that is on the front of one of the volumes, not the information content that is inside any of those volumes. So there we see a very, very serious problem right at the beginning of the matter. We have other problems relating to the fossil record. A very serious one is that the fossil record has not filled up the way Darwin predicted it would. Darwin's original prediction was that evolution was a very slow process of gradual change, and that the reason why he did not see a uniform gradation among the fossils at this time, 1830s and 40s, he did most of his work, was that we didn't have enough of the fossil record. If you had the whole fossil record, you would in fact see a uniform movement from the lowest forms of animals to the highest forms of animals and plants, and you would not see much in the way of gaps. We have much, much better information now, over 100 years after Darwin did his work, and what we find out is the gaps have not disappeared. And evolutionists such as George Gaylord Simpson, who was professor of paleontology at Harvard and considered the outstanding paleontologist in this country, recognizes that. His remark basically is, if I can find it lurking here in my notes, there it is. In spite of these examples, he's just given a couple of examples of sequences, it remains true, as every paleontologist knows, that most new species, genera, and families, and that nearly all the categories above the level of families, appear in the fossil record suddenly and are not led up to by known, gradual, completely continuous transitional sequences. He says something of that sort three times in his work, The Major Features of Evolution. That particular quotation is from page 360. We have a problem of gaps in the fossil record, which modern evolutionary theory is trying to solve on the assumption that evolution happened very quickly with very small populations. Therefore, only very small groups are evolving very quickly up to the next level, and then when you get a big group up there, it stops. You have no evolution at all. There are some very serious problems with that, not the least of which is that it looks like it was designed to solve a problem of the fossil record, but does not solve the theoretical problems which exist of trying to get mutations to produce new, complicated structures that work together. This problem of getting order out of a random process such as mutation with survival as the only thing to select out what is good and bad, nobody has been able to show mathematically produces the kind of order that evolutionists need. There was in fact quite an argument about this a few years ago between mathematicians trying to model evolution on computers and biologists who said it's got to work. The mathematician said, we can't make it work with the model you've given us. If you would like to come back with a better model, we'll try it again. But our problem is that whenever we have an orderly system of information, in fact, that's orderly, like we have in a living thing, when you begin to make random changes, you destroy the order, you destroy the meaning. And we can't find any way to get around this, they said. So that material will be found in a work by Moorhead and Kaplan called Mathematical Challenges to the Neo-Darwinian Interpretation of Evolution. One of the striking examples of the kind of problem you face here is the problem of the sex wasp. This wasp is a wasp which does not kill its victims. It paralyzes its victims. The wasp itself does not even eat meat, but the wasp apparently knows the anatomy of the cicada so well that it knows how to jab the cicada, where to jab the cicada, and how much poison to put in the cicada, not to kill it, but to put it in suspended animation. It then buries the cicada in the hole with the eggs of the next wasp. The next wasp, when it hatches out of its egg, is a meat eater in its larva stage, like it's not when it grows up. And somehow that larva knows to eat the right parts of that cicada so that it doesn't kill the cicada until it's gotten all the meat, because as long as the cicada stays alive, the meat remains fresh. And Lauren Isley, who is an evolutionist himself, feels that this is a very, very puzzling problem for evolution, and he makes some rather striking statements. Let me read you just one or two of them. She carries not alone the surgical instrument, he's just told the hashing out of the new wasp, but a map of operations yet to be performed on an insect she has never seen. She is a nectar feeder, but it is for carnivorous grubs she will labor, the grubs of which she is was once one, feeding on the paralyzed flesh in the sightless gloom of a walled chamber. Here beneath the leaves of the autumn grass let nature, or a part of nature so beautifully, so exquisitely contrived, that it was hard to imagine error, hard to conceive of all the pieces of that intricate puzzle being put together from the blind play of natural selection alone. The entire pattern had to work, or the species would perish. There seemed to be no intermediate possibility. The larva has to feed in a certain way, the adult female has to seek prey upon which it never personally fed. It has furthermore to identify that prey. The wasp has to bring its paralyzed cicada back over distance to a burrow that is already constructed and whose position it is previously mapped with the care of an aerial navigator. To explain this uncanny phenomenon by computerized armchair genetics may be theoretically possible. One starts from certain current assumptions which leave me vaguely uncomfortable. I have come to feel at last that the human version of evolutionary events was perhaps too simplistic for belief, he says. These are the sort of areas that leave me rather unsatisfied scientifically with the theory of evolution. It's rather, I've been very much struck in my study of biblical material that the statements of the Bible are consistent with the data of modern science, and that they give an explanation for the origin of man and such that make very, very good sense out of what man is. Evolution does not.
Thank you. Would you take this time right now, if you have your questions, to put them on the cards, and then would you pass them to the outsides of the rows, and maybe we could have some people collect them?
We're going to get started. You speak of Israel gathering material from surrounding nations to express their belief in God. In other words, Israel formed their ideas of God according to their own opinions and desires. Is that correct? And if so, why should those origins be valuable to us?
One of the basic understandings of biblical theology in the last several decades, and subject to a little revision in view of work by Dr. Turian, is that God is a God of history. God is a God who acts. God is a God who does things. Okay? Now, I would submit that that's where Israel begins, with something that God did in her midst. Now, when something happens, you have to think about it. And in order to think about it, you have to use the concepts, the vocabulary, terms that are immediately at hand. We might wish that Israel were 20th century men who used the same kind of concepts and words and thoughts that we do. Unfortunately, they weren't. They were ancient men. And they thought in concepts that were available to them. Now, the trick, you see, is getting behind the word, the concept, the image, the vocabulary, to what happened in history. The words are simply points. This question says, you know, Israel formed their ideas of God according to their own opinions and desires. Is that correct? No, not correct. They formed their opinions and ideas about God according to the vocabulary that was available to them. But they had experienced God at work in their midst. And it's the experience to which the words are pointing, and human words must always, to some extent, be insufficient to describe the activity of God in our midst. And therefore, why should those opinions be valuable to us? They are valuable to us as guides, as pointers, to where God may be working in our midst. And then we are obligated to use our best words, our best concepts, our best vocabulary to explain where we have seen God at work. And that's basically what preaching is.
Our second question is, how did you arrive at 10 to the 23rd power years for a monkey to rate the Encyclopedia of Canada?
That wasn't too hard. Basically, I chose 3 characters per second because 3 times 33 comes out and make 100, okay? So you get about 100 characters typed per second. Then you just work out the probability of typing out E followed by N followed by C followed by Y, etc. One chance in 33 first, etc., all the way down the line. Once you've got the rate, plus the number of characters that have to be typed to get the result, then you just divide the number of characters by the rate and you get the time necessary to be taken. So that's how I got it.
Okay.
Am I allowed to make rejoinders to Reverend Frame, how are we going to operate that?
Yeah.
I have one problem with this, one problem with his methodology. His methodology seems to be similar to that of G. Ernest Wright, God Who Acts. So where the emphasis is that God acts, but he doesn't say anything, and we've got to guess what he meant. The biblical picture of Revelation, as I see it, is that he does two things. He acts and talks. And the talking greatly decreased the ambiguity regarding what the acts are all about. I would also submit that I think a great deal of his view of early Israelite religious history is based upon a reconstruction on the assumption that the Pentateuch, for instance, the five books of Moses, are in fact written over a period of about 500 years, all of which starts over 500 years after the time of Moses. Taking J, perhaps, 850 would be like, E, 750, D, about 650, let's say, could be a little later, earlier, and P, perhaps about 550, sometime in the Babylonian exile. I see some very serious problems in that area. First of all, that we have no manuscripts of any of these works. Secondly, that we have no tradition that any of these works existed. Thirdly, that it was a methodology that was in vogue in all ancient literature by German literateurs in the last century, but has pretty well been backed away from in the other areas. Fourthly, because most of the schemes of separating the documents are based upon things like repetition, which we find a great deal of in Ugaritic literature and other ancient Near Eastern literature, that itself doesn't seem to be a very good thing. The second would be because it's based upon the whole matter of different names for God, and yet different names for the same God is a rather common phenomenon. In fact, different names for the same individual person is a rather common phenomenon in ancient Near Eastern literature. In fact, you can't divide the Old Testament or even the Pentateuch up into the same kind of documents if you were to choose other types of names to use for the persons rather than names of God.
That is correct. Let us realize, friends, this is 1979. It is over 100 years since source theory was first propounded. It has withstood 100 years of most searching criticism. Certainly it's been refined and developed. See, the problem is that the methods are there, we just don't know how to use them. The methods of biblical scholarship are as precise as many other methods of scientific investigation. And the results that I give you are the best results that can be given at this period of biblical investigation using the tools that are available to us. That doesn't mean that they're absolute. They may be changed over the years ahead in the same way that any scientific theory is not absolute and is subject to continued verification and to alteration as new facts present themselves. Scholarship, biblical scholarship at the present day is, I think, to a large extent in keeping with the presentation that I've given, based on a source analysis, based upon an understanding of a God who acts in history. However, as you noted in my aside, I do believe that that has to be modified to the extent that the God who acts also does speak. But as we know, he speaks through the words that again are available to us. And I do believe there was a interpretive tradition running side by side with the acts that occurred in history that allowed Israel to see God at work in those acts. And part of my own personal scholarly research is to try to illuminate that interpretive tradition that runs parallel to the acts. By the way, Roman Catholic theology becomes very helpful at that point because they have always made much more tradition than we Protestants have, and we can learn some things from them with an understanding of the role of tradition as that which helps us to understand a bare, uninterpreted event that occurs. And I do believe that there is that line of interpretive tradition, especially revealed in the wisdom literature of the scripture. You'll note I dealt quite a bit with wisdom literature in my presentation, Job and Psalms that I used in Proverbs. So yes, that is where we're coming from. You analyze it correctly, and it's for you who are here to, I guess, decide which suits you best. The question is basically one of approach to the sources. And if you find it comfortable dealing with the first five books of the Bible as if Moses wrote them in 1200 BC and wrote at his own death, fine. If you are uncomfortable with that, you should know that there are other theories, which I personally think are more valid theories.
This will give each speaker a chance. It says, given Dr. Newman's rejection of evolution, what can he say about man's creation, especially when and how? And then it asks you to respond in a general comment on Dr. Newman's discussion on evolution and the biblical doctrine of creation.
Okay. I'm not an anthropologist, and so I'm not really into the data as thoroughly as one ought to be to say a great deal about when and how. I do not believe the Bible requires that creation have occurred only a few thousand years ago. There are many, many Bible believers who do believe it occurred only a few thousand years ago, and there are people who have some fairly good arguments in that direction, though I'm not satisfied with them myself. I believe creation occurred quite a long time ago compared to a few thousand years. I would put the origin of the earth on the order of 4 billion years ago. The origin of man, I do not know what sort of a date to suggest. I don't believe the Bible gives us a required date in that area. I think Adam goes back a good deal further than we may have thought from a traditional understanding of the biblical material. So I do not want to climb out a limb on what suggestion there is. A problem among anthropologists of deciding what is and what isn't man at various stages. Certainly, people will agree that if there's evidence of religion connected with the fossil record, then that's a man. Okay. If there are evidences of works, tools of some variety, that's usually considered the evidence of man. When you don't have worked tools, when you have things like broken bones or something that might have been whacked, used to whack something with, you don't know whether you're talking about man or not. So you may be talking about some variety of apes at that point. So I'm not sure I want to make any guesses on when. How, I'm willing to take the biblical account in a rather straightforward way. God apparently created man. The remark is, from the dust of the earth he formed his body. Some people have taken that to be a slow evolution all the way up to ape as the dust of the earth. I'm not too enthusiastic about that way of treating the wording. I don't see any reason to suppose that we're looking at any parabolic explanation here. So I would see a special creation of man and a special creation of woman by an independent event shortly after that, and that there was therefore an original pair, that therefore there is a real fall, and therefore there is really something to be saved from that man has got some responsibility for.
I'm asked to comment on Dr. Newman's discussion on evolution and on the biblical doctrine of creation. Well, that was what I began with, giving you what I think is biblical doctrine of creation. I'm not sure in what area the question wants me to clarify, so the person that presented that might be helpful. They would say where they want me to do a clarification. The comment I would make on the doctrine of evolution is that as a biblical scholar and not a scientist, I am unqualified to make any pronouncement on that subject. I allow those who are qualified to tell me, just as I would like those who are not qualified in biblical scholarship to allow me to tell them. I think that's why we have different scholarly disciplines. And what the scientist has discovered, I will accept his findings until he tells me something different. Now, I believe that the doctrine of evolution, from what I understand, from what Dr. Newman said, from other reading, is still an open matter in many of its points. I think, again, that it has survived several hundred or 150 years almost, and the basic outline may, at this point, have something to commend it to us. But I would want to, not want to make any judgment about it. I'll just let the scientists tell me where they are. Now, can I make one other comment at this point? Concerning the Bible and evolution, that's where I have the problem, you see. because the Bible is not a scientific book. It's a pre-scientific book. It's not trying to tell us about science. It's trying to tell us about theology. And to try to get science out of the Bible just messes us up horribly in our thinking. I usually like to take the time, and I'll do it very quickly, to diagram Genesis chapter 1. If you will read that the way a person reading it for the first time would read it, and not try to use weasel words or modernistic type of explanation to explain away what the words really say, you end up with something like this. You have a flat world. You have a universe, a firmament still over it. You have waters above the earth. You have waters under the earth. You have waters to either side of the earth that have been pushed back when the dry land appeared. You have vegetation on that land. You have the sun and the moon and stars dangling from the firmament. You have a few animals. And lastly, you have the man. Now, I usually say that that's the universe you want. That's the universe you get. Alright? That is the picture that the writers of Genesis 1 had of their universe. It is a pre-scientific understanding of the universe. I usually say, I think God could have made that in 7 days. I think we could have made it in 7 days. So, you know, let's be clear that if we're going to use the Bible, then we have to be fair in the way we use it and take it on its own terms. And this is the picture of the world that we get from Genesis 1, which leads me to the conclusion that the persons who wrote Genesis 1 didn't care that much about the image of the universe and would have been open to say people 1,000 years later might have had a different understanding of how it looked. What they were trying to tell us about was theology, about the creator of the universe. And that's the message that we're meant to get out of Genesis 1, not this.
I'll give one more just for you, okay? It says here, if you had to, could you describe the Darwin theory of evolution in one sentence? I love these questions.
Might be a long sentence.
What time do you got?
The Darwinian theory of evolution claims that life has developed from one simple original form by means of mutations, changes, which are then passed on to future generations, and those changes which are helpful to the organism survive to produce a larger number of descendants than those which do not. A second sentence. If it were basically then one is claiming that merely two mechanisms are functioning, some sort of mutation, which in modern Darwinian, neo-Darwinian terms would be probably either chemical or radioactive changes in the genetic material in the cells, and this then produces either bad results most of the time or good results very, very rarely, and the good results are somehow preferred in reproduction and therefore gradually produce new structures. My problem would be getting the kind of structures we have out of the mechanism we've got. I'm itching to respond to Dr. Frank.
Okay,
I did my thesis, the SDM thesis, biblical on the biblical teaching on the firmament, and I would take exception to his idea that the firmament is some sort of a solid dome. It is true that the term rakiah, from which rakiah comes, is sometimes used for pounding out metal, and therefore one might get the idea that it's a thin metal dome, but it is also used for other things like clouds even, as things spread out, and my understanding of the matter is that we have a creation of the atmosphere there, the water that is, quote, above the firmament, the word al, Hebrew word al used there, can be used for something supported by something else, and therefore does not need to actually be above it, but held up by it in some way. In fact, Hebrew rather regularly, I suppose even English, if we think about it a little, often uses prepositions for actions on non-solid objects that if you took the object, you might misunderstand that saying the object is solid. So we talk about leaves being carried before the wind, as though here's the wind back here and here's the leaves in front of it here. But no, in fact, the wind is pushing the leaves along. And we have a statement in Job of the cloud holding up water and not being ripped under it. Picture of the idea that the water is on top of the cloud, but that's not the real picture. The picture is that the water is being held up in the cloud. Well, that would be my understanding of the firmament matter. Flat Earth is a rather tricky job to come by out of scriptural passages. I'd be interested if Dr. Frayne knows a particular passage that speaks of the Earth being flat. The other areas regarding the question of water under the Earth, or pillars of the Earth, things of that variety, we could hassle a little bit if you would like.
Unless you want me to respond, I'm going to move on to the other question I have here. let me get to this question, because I like this one. All scripture is inspired by God and profitable for teaching, for reproof, for correction, for training in righteousness, that the man of God may be adequately equipped for every good work, 2 Timothy 3:16, 17. Explain how you feel about this. This is one of my favorite passages that I often use, because it clearly tells us what scripture is useful for, and then I would also assume what scripture is not useful for by what is omitted to me. And we must be very careful that we do not use the scripture for all purposes. The purposes for which scripture is designed are clearly outlined in this verse, and I do not think that scientific speculation is one of the uses of scripture. There's a second question here. Do you think man is sinful? I don't know how that ties in. The answer is yes.
There's one more question for Reverend Frayne, which we'll do, and then the rest of these will be open for either one to answer. This is a specific one. It says, when did monotheism become a religious characteristic of Judaism?
Monotheism is defined as belief in one God and at the same time denying the existence of any other gods. Okay? We would call that theoretical monotheism. I don't believe you can talk about theoretical monotheism being practiced in Judaism until the time of the exile, which would be about 550 B.C. in the writings of the prophet that we now call Second Isaiah. we get the first appearance of what would be clearly identified as theoretical monotheism. Prior to that time, the more appropriate term is the term henotheism, which means worship of one God without necessarily denying the existence of others. The Hebrews were henotheists. They were willing to admit there were other gods besides Yahweh, but they didn't care about those other gods because their loyalty was to Yahweh and to Yahweh alone.
And the last one, I see that this is just for you. If the earth was made from a gas cloud, would the gas cloud not diffuse throughout space instead of condensing
it? That depends, of course, on the size of the gas cloud and the temperature of the gas cloud and its density. And the answer is that gravitation is a force which is only attractive, it is not repulsive, and given a large enough amount of gas, almost no matter what its temperature is, it will begin to contract. Now, for a small enough amount of gas to contract into the Earth, you won't get it. But if you would like to try a small enough amount of gas to contract into the solar system, indeed you can get a cloud that will do that. The general understanding of the matter is that the Earth and the various planets were formed, scientifically speaking, as a byproduct of the formation of the Sun, and then what you get is, as a cloud contracts, you begin to get the formation of very fine particles out of certain material. And this, these fine particles collide with one another and form rather large objects. So I'm not speaking here of a one-stage form of gas collapsing down to form a solid planet, but rather of the gas collapsing to form what is going to be the Sun, and then the Sun putting out some of this material in an equatorial band, and the granular material forming up into a planet. I have a long discussion of my views of this matter in a work put up by University Press. I'm going to give my own advertisement since someone asked. Genesis 1 and the Origin of the Earth, which spends a little time discussing how this particular theory goes. I don't guarantee that it's the right one, but I do believe that the best theories available to planetologists today fit the biblical material quite well. So That, I think, is rather significant now. Okay.
This is a question, and either or both can answer. Since Earth is just one part of the total universe, is there any indication that there could be life on other planets?
Not clear from the question whether the writer means scientific indication or scriptural indication. I'll leave the scientific question to anybody else. But the scriptural answer would be there is no clear indication that there is. There's no clear indication that there isn't. The clear indication is that our God is the God of all that is, and that our Christ is the cosmic Christ.
I would not disagree with this statement on the biblical matter. I don't know of any statement one way or the other. Biblical material would indicate anything. So we do agree now and then. The scientific situation is much beclouded by the question of whether evolution is true or not. If life did not form from non-life by natural processes, then anybody's guess is as good as anyone else's on whether God chose to create something somewhere else, okay? If life formed naturally from non-life, then no one still knows how likely it is, and all sorts of wide ranges have been suggested for the matter. So it's actually a question that's up in the air, both from a biblical and scientific perspective.
This is the question. And God saw that the light was good. Does this statement mean that God wasn't sure how his creation of light would develop? Wasn't God in total control of his creation and the result?
Yes, I think so. I think God is basically making a comment on the matter. I think we have occasional statements that God saw something, things of that variety. Indicates to us that God is reacting to something and is going to do something about it. God saw that the actions of men were only evil continually. We have just before the flood account. He knew it already, but he's now going to do something about it. And so we have a picture there of just as someone comes to realize something and then takes action about it, we have God pictured in that same way. So I would understand this statement in that way. God is observing the result, and what he makes is good. And I think we have the same situation, too, in Genesis chapter 2. God is not trying out several thousand experiments with different types of animals to see if any of them will be fit as a companion for man, but rather he's trying to show man something, that none of these is quite like woman. So,
okay, while you're on Genesis 2, and this is for either person, was man created after animals as in Genesis 1, or was man created before animals as in Genesis 2?
I'll get in my way first. I leave that question scientifically to the scientist to answer. I believe I know the answer. I think the answer is that man is a late development on the earth, which would then mean the animals would come before. From a biblical perspective, we have two stories. And this is the whole point. And it shows us that we can't use them scientifically. Scientifically, the one story is wrong. The other story is right. Scientifically, theologically, they are both right. Because they are trying to make affirmations about the importance of man. One way you can affirm something's importance is by leaving it to last, which is what Genesis 1 does. Another way you can affirm something's importance is by putting it first, which is what Genesis 2 does. So theologically, the two stories are both correct. Scientifically, one is probably not.
Well, I better respond to that one. First of all, if I were taking my car to the garage, and I'm not a great mechanic, but I opened the hood, and I said, I think there's something wrong with this thing. And he says, no, your carburetor looks all right. And I notice he's holding the coil. I will definitely take my car to another garage before I allow the person to proceed with other tinkering with the car. If a person who is claimed to be the creator of the universe cannot tell the story straight on how he put it together, I'm going to be very skeptical of trusting him with my salvation. Now, the question is, which of these two accounts gives us the chronological order of the thing, or do both of them claim to give us a chronological order of the account? I would understand that Genesis 1 gives us a chronological order. Genesis 2 brings up the animals after it mentions man, because it has an intention of bringing the animals before man for him to make a test. reconstruction there, evolved consecutive, is occasionally used for examples that do not require a chronological sequence. Genesis 24:15 would be an example. I would look at a couple of those if you'd like. So I would make that particular suggestion. In any case, even from a multi-document view, you've got to wonder how the final redactor must have put two accounts together if he understood that they were contradictory. Surely the final redactor understood Hebrew syntax better than we do today. I also find it rather doubtful that the Genesis 2 account is intended to picture God as a bungler who has to make several attempts before he gets a helper suitable for man, which one would understand in terms of creating man first and creating the first animal, having named that, no good, create the next one, name that, no good, etc., that particular situation. So that would be my response to the matter, to deny that we have two accounts, but rather that we have a close-up in the second account of something that's been narrated in very brief a form in the first account.
I would like you to feel that we ought to be very happy we have two different accounts. If I were presenting the subject to you tonight, on which there were two theories, and wanted to be completely fair and objective, I would present both theories. I would not try to harmonize them. I would not try to make one subservient to the other. What Genesis 1 and 2 shows is that the compilers of these documents have great respect for tradition. And when they received two variant stories in the tradition, they were not about to harmonize them or to give one priority over the other. In fairness, they preserve both stories. And they leave it up to us.
Explain something about the longer lifespan of people in the Old Testament as compared to our present lifespan.
I'd like to hear yours first.
Well, I would take it at its word on the matter of being a longer lifespan. Some people have suggested, they use a different unit of measurement, short years or something of that variety. If you work out the genealogies, however, you find out if you have sons awfully early, if you try and convert 900 years into 70 years or something like that. So it seems to me we're talking about actual ages. Some have suggested, in fact, that the same tradition of long-lived people is preserved also in the Babylonian material. Now, as to why that would be so, there have been suggestions made by Christians regarding water above the firmament blocking the rays and things of that variety. I'm not enthusiastic about those myself. I will say this. We don't know why people die today. If we knew why people die today, I'm talking scientifically, we'd be doing a lot more about it than we are. We're doing a good deal about it right now. And we just frankly don't understand aging. And whether it's a genetic problem of some sort, whether it's a problem due to various other things we do not know, the scripture suggests that the difference between immortality and non-immortality is a matter of sin. Whether we can expand that, say, the difference between a 900-year lifespan and a 70-year lifespan is a further effect of sin, I do not know, but I would not rule that out as a possibility.
You can guess what my answer is already. Say that somebody lived 900 and some years must be approached first not as a scientific statement but as a theological statement. There's a theological reason for the declining length of man's life. And in terms of the priestly writers, it is the infection of sin. And we're to understand theologically that sin decreases the value of life, the quality of life, the quantity of life. That sin just robs us of the fullness of life that God wants us to have. That's the theological statement being made by those stories. As has already been indicated, there are Babylonian sources that indicate some of the ancient Babylonian king was as much as 10,000 years. So I guess if a Babylonian king could live 10,000 years, Methuselah would only be able to live 969.
Okay. Would either of you venture a guess as to what man looked like when he was created, because he was supposed to be created in God's image? And tied in with this, is it possible for Christians to believe in evolution, saying that even if man was created to look like an ape or in ape form, that God was the ultimate creator?
What did man look like when he was created? Well, I don't know. The Bible doesn't give a description of what he looked like, okay? And our tendency in our Sunday school pictures, they have him look quite Aryan and handsome and things that variety. I suppose he didn't look ugly, but I don't know what he looked like. The biblical picture of man being created in God's image, I do not think is referring to physical image. I think it is referring to man is able to do certain things that God can do which the animals cannot do. And those image, that features of his image involve matters of morality, that man has got a moral structure, which is far too much the animals do not have, that man at one time had immortality according to the biblical account, which God has, it's not clear the animals ever had, so that's an arguable position. But I would see largely man's image, being an image of God, falling into the area of moral matters. Also another, perhaps another area would be the area of ability to dominate, the whole idea of man as the steward over creation. Man has to have these creatures under him, just as God has all creation under him. This, I think, another feature relating to man being made in the image of God. I think I forgot what the second half of that question was.
Okay, the second half of the question was, can a Christian believe in evolution if he believes that even if man was made and look like apes, or, you know, since we have no description of him.
Can they? Surely. I don't think there's any question. Christians can believe all sorts of things. I think there are some minimal matters which a person would need to believe to be a Christian by biblical definition. And the most important one of these, it seems to me, would be the matter to realize that he cannot be acceptable before God on his own steam, and that without trusting in the work that Christ has done on the cross, that person is not going to be able to stand in the judgment. As regards whether a person can believe this or not, there certainly are many people who believe it, who I suspect are Christians. Whether I would recommend them to believe it or not is another matter. I don't recommend anybody believe anything that is false, and I personally believe that the teaching of evolution, at least in regard to the origin of man, is incorrect. But I think they can believe it.
Just that the question of belief on a scientific matter is kind of silly, isn't it? It really doesn't matter whether you believe it or not if it's true. Think about that. When we say do you believe in evolution or not, if we're going to reduce evolution to a matter of faith, then you have to talk about belief in it. If we leave it a scientific hypothesis, then it isn't a matter whether you believe in it or not. Belief does not apply to science. It's what is verifiable and demonstrable that one accepts. It's silly to use the word belief. The classic example I like is the oft-told story about Galileo as an old man who was hauled before the Inquisition in Italy. And he had gone along with the new theories of Copernicus that the earth was not the center of the universe, but the sun was, and the earth moved around the sun. And he was asked to sign a document recanting the belief that the earth moves around the sun. He, of course, signed the document, and then was heard to mutter under his breath, "But it still moves." Not a matter of belief, matter of fact.
I agree to a certain extent on that. Obviously, what we believe about the universe is not going to change the universe. If we believe it was created and it wasn't, it's not going to change. If we believe it wasn't created and it is, it isn't going to change. That's true in science. That's true in theology, too, I presume. However, it does make a big difference what we believe. A scientist who believes in evolution may spend his whole life working on certain areas with that as a groundwork for his theories, for his work, and would be rather perturbed to find out when he died that that was wrong, and that he had basically wasted his life working in that particular direction all the time. Certainly, there are many areas in science which are controversial, and you have people who contend very strongly for the position they hold and try and see the data in that way. And I believe in science we often find that, in fact, the best arguments are worked out by people who believe a certain position. They will work to find, see what the evidence is, and it's by the struggle of these arguments against one another that people are able to come to see what arguments have the strength for them and what arguments are very weak arguments.
We have three real quick questions and give each of you a couple minutes for summary. I assume this is for you. Please comment on the regression theory, the example, man created but some went down in evolution.
Don't know that there's any biblical support for that particular idea. Perhaps some have gotten it out of the idea of a golden age followed by lower powered ages later, something of that sort. The biblical picture is, man is a disaster area, okay? What's a disaster? A ruin, like in either term. That's a term some of you use. Man is a ruin. What's a ruin? A ruin is not something that never was anything, and it's not something that gives no evidence that it never was anything. It's something that was something very great at one time, and has now been badly damaged. So perhaps we think of the ruins of the Parthenon, and although it's not a very good place to get in out of the rain, the roof is gone, and you probably would not want to have it to live in, though it's got very fine marble, yet it shows evidence that the people who put it together were very confident architects and craftsmen, and that they did a very fine job. Man is kind of like that, and I think it shows up through his history. Man is made in the image of God and has great capabilities, but he's been so infilled by sin that he mucks up these capabilities about the time he gets something good going. And so the history of civilization as we know it anyway, once you get to prehistoric times, it becomes much trickier to know what was going on exactly, is of high peaks followed by quite disastrous valleys. And we can see this in the Greek civilization, the Roman civilization, the Hittites, the Egyptians, all of these civilizations, and we may well one day see it in our civilization, though I hope not.
Okay, and the last question for Dr. Newman. With the age of the earth being what it is, and our sun being the size and type that it is our sun overdue for extinction? And could the earth have been formed under a dark sun?
Not quite sure what a dark sun is. The sun we're under is not a dark sun. And it looks like certain features of the formation of the Earth would require some is working, when it's beginning to produce heat and light. The question about whether we are overdue to become a piece of rubble to the Earth, an exploding star or something of that sort, or inside a red giant, most scientists are rather optimistically predict that we're only about halfway through the sun cycle that started about 5 billion years ago and it's got about 5 billion years to go. For a fact, the details on stellar light cycles are not well worked out. The present theories predict a certain amount of flow of certain types of particles out from inside the sun called neutrinos, and we can't find those neutrinos. And that suggests that something is awry with the theory. What it is, I do not know. I certainly can see some rather interesting features in the passage in 2 Peter of the elements burning up with fervent heat that would look a little bit like being too close to a nova, an exploding star. But I won't venture any guesses in that direction.
Would you like to take a few minutes and just give us a little summary of your ideas?
Yes, I think we're looking at two very different perspectives on Scripture here, in Dr. Frame and myself. I believe that the biblical material is a revelation from God in the sense that the God who put together the universe and who created man and who controls history has revealed himself to us in the biblical material. That the five books of Moses are from the Mosaic period and written under Moses' direction, though I do not find it necessary to take the last few verses of Deuteronomy as being Moses' own handwritten prediction of what was going to happen to him. I have no problem with the things of that variety being put on at the end or even now and then little footnotes here and there in the text. My whole problem would be that to make the five books of Moses, something to be scattered out over a 500-year period, starting almost 500 years after the time of Moses, ending near 1,000 years after the time of Moses, goes against the statements of the material itself, goes against the statements elsewhere in the Old Testament and the New Testament, and goes against the statements of Jesus himself. I take Jesus to be one who was truly God, who chose to become a man for the salvation of mankind, and that although he put away certain features of his deity while he was on earth, one of which was his full knowledge, he did not know the time of his return, yet he was filled with the Holy Spirit, so that as a prophet he did not tell us wrong things. He did not tell us certain things that had not been revealed to him in his incarnate state at that time, but what he did tell us I would understand to be correct.
And so I would take the material and put it in that way. As I pointed out before, I would be very skeptical of the theological statement of a work that claims to come from the God who made heaven and earth and who controls history, and then find that its historical statements and that its scientific statements are incorrect. Regarding the matter of the Bible being a theological book rather than a scientific book, I think we can say that there's some merit to that statement, certainly. But on the other hand, that it speaks in pre-theological language, just as it speaks in pre-scientific language, but I contend that the God who made the universe is able to use simple language to convey profound truths, and that he has put things in his word which would not have been understood at the time, but which further research would make it possible to understand. And I would suggest that some of the features connected with Genesis 1 that I suggested fall in this area. I do not rest my case on the inspiration of Scripture, merely on the ability to fit the scientific materials together. I would rest it as well on evidences of fulfilled prophecy, evidences that the God who made the Bible is able to predict things before they come to pass because he controls things sufficiently for that. And these lines of evidence, I think, are evidences which liberal theology has not done a very good job on. I would see then in the Genesis account a orderly, very simple account given to us from the perspective of one standing on earth watching things happen, of the creation of the earth, its land masses, its atmosphere, its plant life, animal life, and man, and the picture of man as being the one who is set over all of these things with responsibility to carry out before God.
As hopefully you have perceived, the basic issue that has been dealt with tonight is not the issue of creation and evolution. The basic issue that's been dealt with is the cause for sometimes raising the issue of creation and evolution, and that is the way in which we utilize the biblical sources. My contention would be that as long as we refuse to recognize what the biblical record really is and benefit from the insights of modern biblical scholarship, we will continue to have debates over creation versus evolution and on hundreds of other subjects where we pit the Bible against the findings of modern science. If we learn to use the Bible right, those difficulties will disappear.
Thank you very much.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.